All right. Thank you for attending the session. Number 237, titled From Lingering Longer to Bowling Alone, Tracking the Changes in Community and Social Capital Related to Faith Transitions. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. The session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the Sunstone magazine and podcast at the registration desk as well. Concessions will be open in the venue for lunch, or you're welcome to visit local restaurants in the area. Please return by 1:45 to get a seat in the next session. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your programs, this presentation description is as follows. The LDS Church has historically been a social hub for many of its members, and as one's orthodoxy wanes, often so too does one's sense of community and belonging. This presentation will examine Robert Putnam's research on the interplay between social capital, community, and religion in the Mormon context, and will tackle the following questions. What happens when a faith transition causes one to lose social capital? How can those who leave rebuild a new community? What can the institutional church do to keep unorthodox member engaged? How does one's social capital and sense of community affect one's mental health? Kelly Furr is a licensed associate marriage and family therapist in Yuma, Arizona. She serves on the board of the Mormon Mental Health Association. And now we turn the time over to the presentation.
All right. I'm going to hold this because I'm kind of soft-spoken. So, like you said, my name is Kelly Furr. This is my fourth year coming to and presenting at Sunstone. And every year I like to kind of pick a topic related to mental health or the social sciences related to the theme, and this year's theme of the nun, you know, the increase of the nun made me really think it would be good to talk about what does your social life do? How does it change when you stop wanting to go to the linger longers? sometimes you feel like, you know, you might feel alone. And so we're going to kind of use some of the research of Robert Putnam. He's written some books. The first one he's written that we're going to talk about is Bowling Alone. That came out about 20 years ago. Some of you may have heard about it or read it. And this book really kind of sets up the basic understanding of what social capital is, how it works, why it's important, why it's kind of been declining in America in general over the last 75 years or so. The next book, you want me to go back for a second? Okay, then the next book I'm going to pull some information from is another work by Putnam and David Campbell, who happens to be Mormon. And this is more a discussion about how your religious participation affects your social life, your politics, your relationships within your congregation, and maybe the relationships of different faiths together. And it's mostly talking about Christian faiths, just because Americans are mostly Christian. And then also Jana Reese's book, The Next Mormons, will kind of pull in some information on Mormons in particular. And if you haven't read this yet, I really loved it. It's a great, great book. So we'll start by talking about just what is social capital. It's just this idea that your social networks have value or capital, and your social networks generate feelings of trustworthiness and reciprocity, which make your everyday interactions less costly. And it's not so much that you trust other people, but it's that you perceive others as trustworthy. And that's what kind of makes the difference. So just as an example, several years ago when I lived in Florida, a friend came to visit me. We went to the Everglades in a national park, like a couple hours in the middle of nowhere, and I locked my keys in the car. And I didn't have any friends in the national park. I didn't know anybody. There was a friendly park ranger that tried to help me, but he ended up doing some damage to my car by trying to like wedge a little thing in there to open it. And so I had to call a locksmith that had to drive in there, and it was pretty expensive, right? So it was expensive with time, it was expensive with money, it was really stressful. And then just this summer, like a month ago, I locked my keys and my phone in my car. Again, I do this sometimes. But this time it was at my kids' swimming practice. And it's Newham, Arizona, so it's 110 degrees out. I have my baby in the stroller, but I wasn't as stressed out as I was with the other one because I knew that in a few minutes someone would pull up that I knew, and someone did, and it was someone whose kid's on the swim team with mine and goes to my ward, and the kids are in the same primary class and school class with my kids. And so I said, hey, I just locked my phone and my keys in the car. Can you take me home to get my keys? And she said, sure, you know. So she runs me home in 10 minutes. We come back, and it's not a big deal. And so it saved me money. It saved me time. It saved me stress. And so this is just gives you an idea of what social capital does for you in your life. It just makes things easier. So there's a couple different types of reciprocity. Specific reciprocity is the idea of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and let's time it for 5 minutes each so it's fair, right? Like just this kind of even exchange. And then there's the idea of generalized reciprocity, which means like I'll help you now without expecting a reward because I believe that you or somebody else is going to eventually help me later when I need it. And it sounds like selfless, and we talk about it being selfless in church, but it's really not. It's a short-term altruism, but long-term self-interest. So we help people because we believe that we will somehow be benefited eventually. And it's just that idea of karma, the golden rule, like if you put good things out, you'll get it back. And that's kind of how our LDS wards thrive, because everybody is serving, everybody's contributing, but we all like to say we're selfless service, but we also know that we're getting back some sort of benefit socially from participating in the ward. So Putnam talks about two different types of social capital, bonding and bridging. And at certain points in the presentation, it may sound like one type is better than the other, but they're both really important for different reasons. So bonding social capital reinforces exclusive identities in homogenous groups. And so it's what our wards and our Mormon communities do. You stick together and you reinforce your identity there. And this is what you need for getting by. So that's what helped me when I locked my keys in my car. You're all there in a little group helping each other. And it really strengthens and bolsters your narrower identity. So this is where you're strengthening your identity. I am a Mormon. I go to this college. I am on this team. And you're kind of creating this identity. And Putnam calls this sociological superglue. We all need it. It's really, really important to feel like you're a part of a group. And then there's another type called bridging social capital. And this is more outward-looking and diverse. And this is good for getting ahead. So it's sort of counterintuitive, but your weak social ties are actually better for helping you find jobs because your closer connections, you all know the same people. So if I was going to ask my best friend and my dad about a job, they probably know the same opportunities that I know, but the people you don't know as well know other people that you don't know at all, and they help you connect and network. And so it's helpful in a different way. And this generates your broader identity, like we're all Americans or we're all humans, and it makes you feel together in a broad sense. And he calls this sociological WD-40. It just kind of greases the wheels of human interaction and helps us all kind of get along. So there's a lot of benefits to social capital. He says trustworthiness lubricates social life. So if you've ever lived in a place that has those little free libraries where people put them out in their yard and they put a bunch of books in there, the idea is like you can take a book and put one back. Well, you don't see those in like inner city Chicago, right? If you believe that all of the books are going to be taken out if you put them in your library, then you're not going to do it. So it's working on this principle that I trust and my community is trustworthy enough to participate in this program, that I put books out there, they'll take one, but they'll put one back. And so that's the principle that we use for the lay ministry in our church too, right? So it's the belief, well, if you're totally Orthodox, it's the belief that I can trust any one of these people to teach my children the truth about the gospel. And isn't that great that we can all do that? And Sister Jones is going to teach my kids about eternal families and such and such. So if you're skeptical about that, which I am, that's because you've lost a little bit of that connection, right? You may not find that everyone in your ward is trustworthy enough to teach your daughter about chastity or whatever, you know? So it's easier if you trust everybody and believe it, but it's not always possible once you have a little disconnection right there. So it's also good for like free rider problems, like when your town asks you to not turn on your sprinklers because there's a drought. If there's a lot of community trustworthiness, you're more likely to follow that rule. If there's no trust or you don't care about your community, you're just going to say, I don't care, I'd rather have green grass. So screw everybody else, right? And this same principle applies to like the cleaning the church idea. Like, well, everybody takes a turn and we all chip in and isn't that so awesome? And I think it's actually pretty disgusting, but my trustworthiness issue on that isn't so great, right? Because I think nobody's actually scrubbing the toilets as much as they really need to be cleaned. But that's a different talk. So, but you get the idea, right? So it's this idea that we all trust each other to, and if you have that trust, it just makes everything move smoother. So it just can lead to safer and more productive cities and wards. He talks about how this keeps bad things from happening to good kids. So in the book, it talks about Catholic schools and how, you know, Catholic schools invest a lot in the community. Maybe it's not better academically necessarily, but it creates a safe little bubble. And so I would apply that same principle to LDS wards, how we invest so much time in seminary and youth programs to really create a little nice place for Mormon kids. And I think sometimes in our space here, it can seem like a bad thing, but it really is a good benefit for a lot of people if you can exist in a faithful space to feel like supported in that way. And as I mentioned, it can lead to economic prosperity too. That's, in my opinion, why LDS people are like all over multi-level marketing, because they're taking advantage of their social ties. If you do that too much, though, you're going to actually lose social capital, right? Because people are going to not want to be scammed by you over and over. So anyway, those are just some of the benefits to social capital. So how does social capital affect your mental health? This isn't rocket science, but the more socially connected you are, the healthier you are. And people cope better with trauma and fight illness more effectively the more socially connected you are. And this statistic I thought was actually a little disturbing. People who are socially disconnected are 2 to 5 times more likely to die from all causes. So, I mean, it makes sense though, right? If you're all alone and you're less likely to take care of yourself, you're less likely to care. Whereas, you know, married people, there's research out there that says married people live longer, especially married men, have someone looking at them, out for them to take care of them. So happiness is predicted by the breadth and depth of your social connections. So that's all the good news. The bad news is that in general, American social capital and civic engagement has been declining for decades. So in a couple of minutes, I'll get to why. But first, I just want to talk about the relationship between religion and social capital in particular. And Putnam says that faith communities in which people worship together are arguably the single most important repository of social capital in America. And I think that is such an interesting idea, and I think really true. He says half of all associational memberships, personal philanthropy, and volunteering occur in a religious context. And that's definitely true in the LDS Church, right? I mean, you're automatically a member of the biggest women's organization in the world. If you're a member of the Relief Society, you don't have to do anything, but you are. In the LDS Church, most people spend probably all of their philanthropic money on tithing, you know, with probably little or less donations to other causes. And we do a heck of a lot of volunteering in an LDS ward setting, right? But not only do people who go to church participate more in their churches, but they're also more likely to vote, more likely to participate in secular activities, and just to know more people in general. And part of the reason is because if you know Sister So-and-so from your ward, and she's on the parent-teacher organization at the school, she might also ask you to like participate in the school carnival. So people who are just engaged in any level are asked to help out in other areas and more likely to connect. So education is the best predictor of civic engagement. The more educated you are, the more likely you are to participate in your community. But after that, religion predicts it the best. So even if you're not as highly educated, if you go to church, you're likely to be participating in your community. And church really enhances democracy. It's one of the last places where low-income and minority citizens can learn some of those civic skills that we take for granted, like giving a talk, running a meeting. It's one of the last places where for cross class relationships. If I look at my personal life, that's true, you know. And so church can really help people learn some of those skills that they can take outside of the institution of religion and use outside of that. And it's not the religious beliefs that produce engagement. So it's not like, well, I believe that Jesus said I should do unto others as I want done unto me. Actually, that's not it. That's the golden rule, that I should love others or whatever. It's not that that makes me engage. It's that it's my social ties, right? Like I said, if you know somebody who is in your elders' quorum and he's coaching soccer, he may ask you to be the assistant coach on the soccer team or bring the snacks or whatever. So we're going to talk about why Putnam says that we've declined in social capital, but first I'm just going to mention how social change happens in a couple different ways. So first is the period effect, which means a lot of people change all at once, and it's detectable across all of the generations, and it happens quickly. So it doesn't happen often, but it happens quickly. So like when TV is invented or everybody gets smartphones in a period of time, suddenly there's a huge shift. So with TV, you know, everybody's out engaged, and then suddenly we're actually at home watching TV instead. Then there's a life cycle effect, which doesn't really change society, but in your personal life, it's kind of like a bell curve, where like it peaks around middle age when you've got kids participating in the community a lot. You're very engaged with things because you're helping them out. And then as you get older and your health declines, you're less likely to be participating. And then there's generational change, which means society changes, but individuals don't. And this is slower. So it's the idea that groups that come of age at different times behave and believe differently than each other. So like my grandparents' generation feels very differently about LGBT issues than my generation. And that's has not a lot to do with individuals changing their minds. It's just, you know, culture changes over time. And Putnam says that reversing generational change is like trying to reheat bathwater that has gone cold. So just a little bit of change isn't going to do anything, but you would need like a drastic change in the opposite direction, like a huge infusion of hot water all at once to reheat the bath, which is sort of unlikely. Okay, so this is why he says that social capital in America in general has declined. He says half of it is generational change. So the generation that came of age during World War II, like my grandparents, they had this real bonding experience. This external conflict of the war generated internal cohesion so that when they came home, they have this strong American identity and they're participating like crazy, forming all sorts of societies. And generations after that didn't really have like a catalyzing event that created that same need or desire to participate at that same level. He did argue in a follow-up article that, so he published his book in 2000, and then in 2001, of course, were the terrorist attacks, and he did sort of argue that my generation, that was a bit of sort of like a wake-up kind of bonding, activating experience. And then we've got electronic entertainment like TV as 25% of the disengagement, like I said. If you're spending like 4 hours binge-watching shows on Netflix, you just don't really have the time to be out running some organization. And that was before smartphones, so I think that smartphones could affect it a couple different ways. I think you can engage more on some levels, but less in others. And then he says part of it is two-career families. If you just have, there's more pressure for time and money now. People just don't have as many resources to spend out in the community. And then there's people like me, like well-educated women who in a different time may have been in charge of like a volunteer organization, but instead I got a job, you know. So I'm spending my time differently. And then a little bit of it is also the suburbanization, commuting sprawl. If you're spending 45 minutes in the car each way, you just don't have as much time to engage in your community. And just a brief mention of the internet, since that was sort of after the book. He mentioned these terms, cyber balkanization and the splinternet, which I thought were little catchy phrases that I never heard before, but the idea that on the internet you can break off in little groups and that are just believing like you. And it sounds sometimes like a bad thing, like, oh, well, we're isolated from others and we only think like ourselves. And that's true to an extent, but also there's so much support for, there's so much good things to be found on the internet when you bond with people like you. So, you know, I participate in several Facebook groups like the Waters of Mormon online, where it's just a really nice breath of fresh air to be amongst like-minded thinkers. And so you can see like sort of pros and cons with that. And it is easier to maintain some of those loose social ties with social media. I've moved like 5 times in the last 15 years, and I'm still friends on Facebook with people like 4 states ago, whereas I totally would have lost touch otherwise. So we're going to take just a few minutes to talk about how the shift in religion, how things have changed since the 1950s, and how that ties into social capital. So the 1950s, like I mentioned, when people got home from World War II, they're attending church at like record levels. This is, you know, previously like men weren't attending as much, and people with less education weren't attending as much, but people are coming back from the war and attending church a lot. The 50s are when we put "In God We Trust" on our coins, when we added "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance, and it just, people are like super into religion. But then we have the 60s and 70s. As we know, it's kind of like a different time. It's before my time, but as I've learned, you know, we've got the assassinations of presidents and civil rights leaders and the Vietnam War, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, women's liberation, and it's just, I love this because I think the millennials get a lot of grief these days for like pulling away, but actually it was my parents, it was the boomers who pulled away too first, right? They're just kind of disillusioned with church and religion, and they're backing away. And then there's these two aftershocks. So the first aftershock is that a lot of conservative people were not so into like the loose morals of the 60s and 70s, right? So you have this pullback or pull together of people who are really turned off by that. And in response to the sexual immorality, they're really kind of doubling down. And I think we saw that a lot in Mormon faith too, in addition to the evangelical community. But this is really when politics and religion begin to sort of align. Before this time, it wasn't really a big thing, but this is when it's like, oh, if you're a good evangelical, you're also a good Republican, and these sort of come together. And then you've got another aftershock in the 90s and 2000s, where my generation is kind of like, actually, that's kind of not my thing to be, you know, seeing that being conservative politically is like the same as being religious. So this is when you got the second rise of the nuns, where people are kind of pulling back from religion again. So there's some trends in social capital, how different religious groups spend their social capital. So evangelicals and fundamentalists and Mormons go in that group, invest their social capital within their group in a way that supports the life of the congregation. So whereas Protestants and Catholics are more likely to invest in the broader community, so they're more likely to have a soup kitchen or, you know, drives to support their broader community. And I think it's easy for me to stand here and say, well, that's better because that's more Christ-like, they're serving more. But there's a real benefit to creating a little bonded group, a nice little home for your members. The fundamentalist evangelical Mormon side, they're emphasizing personal piety. It's kind of that like American dream, manifest destiny. What you do and your choices leads to your success. And the Protestant Catholics are emphasizing more the social reform gospel, like let's just help others serve. And there's a real benefit to both, obviously. But the Protestants are losing a lot of members because they're not providing enough of that social capital, not enough bonding experiences. And I'm actually a product of that. I grew up Presbyterian, but I was drawn to the LDS Church, I think specifically because it did provide that bonding, kind of nurturing social capital that my Protestant church did not. It was just that sense of community was not there. And so I think sometimes we can feel like, oh, our church doesn't do enough outreach, which it doesn't. It does do a really, really good job of creating that bonding social capital space. So here are some information about religious retention. There's a picture of the temple there, but this information is about kind of all Christian religions in America, not just Mormons. So the most important factor in predicting retention is whether your family of origin was religiously homogenous and observant or not. So kids whose parents both go to the same church are more likely to stay if they were active. Children of mixed marriages are more likely to leave the religion and become nuns. And the kids involved in religious activities in childhood are more likely to stay. And the church knows all of this information, right? Which is why they push so hard to fit people into this little box. Like, look, if you just both stay active and you just both put your kids in all the activities, then you have the best chance of success, right? That's the way you should do it. But I thought this statistic was really interesting. 35 to 40% of all Americans and 40 to 45% of white Americans, which is like more like in line with our Mormon demographic, right, have switched religions at some point. That's like a lot of people. So I just think that's important because our framework of faith transition is, well, it's a sin, or you were led away by Satan, or this is a problem. And really, it's a developmentally normal experience in America. So many people change their religion and change their faith. So here are just a few fun facts from Jan Riis's book. Members with only a high school education are less Orthodox, and converts are less Orthodox. About half of Mormons outside of Utah are converts, and so math equals less Orthodoxy outside of Utah. And I don't think you needed a social scientist to tell you that, but it's just interesting, right? So there's less Orthodoxy outside of Mormon, outside of Utah. It's like same thing, right? Seminary graduates, a third of them more likely to be Mormon as adults. 17% across all age groups are doubting the church, which is a little higher, I think, than you would guess based on the rhetoric across the pulpit, I think. Divorced and separated Mormons, a little more likely to be doubters. I think that makes sense, right? Because they've had an experience in their life that goes against the narrative of what you should do. It makes you think about it a little bit more. And political independence, some more likely to be doubters than either Republicans or Democrats, which I also think makes sense because independents are sort of in a space where they're open to think about it. You know, they're not in a space of certainty. So here's a few reasons why social networks are important in the LDS Church. The fewer Mormon friends and family you have, the more likely you are to doubt. Your doubting increases as you have more loved ones who leave the church. Doubting's least common when all your closest friends are LDS. And the LDS Church is losing half of people that haven't gone on a mission, a third of people who come home early, but 9 out of 10 people who go on a mission stay in the church, which is interesting, right? This is from Jana Reese's book. So you can see how important social networks are to Mormons, right? It has a lot to do with the people around you. And some people, it has a lot to do with the doctrine, of course. But for a lot of people, it has to do with your social network and what that support level is like. Okay. So what can the church do to help keep those less Orthodox people engaged? In my opinion, rather than trying to get everyone to fit into that little mold of good ads, like, okay, we know that if both parents are active and if you attend, you know, seminary, that you're going to stay in the church, so everybody needs to do that. And if you don't, then it's your fault because that's not as righteous of a behavior, and, well, we could have predicted that. You know, rather than do that, let's make it easier to be different. I mean, a lot of people are not fitting into that mold, so how can we make it a more comfortable place to be if you don't fit into that mold? Christ really encouraged engagement with people who had the least social capital, right? So if you look at his life, he's hanging out with prostitutes and lepers and tax collectors and people that didn't have a whole lot of social capital back then. And I really, if you are still active and kind of going along with the Come Follow Me curriculum at church right now, it's in the book of Acts, and it's really all about how the early apostles de-emphasized the rigidity of the Jewish law of Moses and kind of said, like, you actually don't need to do any of that anymore. You don't have to get circumcised. They're like, whew, you know. You don't have to keep the law of Moses or sacrifice animals, or doesn't matter so much what you eat. What we need is a broken heart, a contrite spirit, get baptized, we're good, you know. So I think our current disciples could really learn a lot from that model, right? Like, let's figure out how we can be less rigid in our structure, and how can we hold on to, like, what is really important about our Christian values, and make a space for people who are a little bit outside of the normal group. There is a word for that, which is the liminals, those standing on the threshold of a religion. Putnam says that pretty much every religion has about 10% of people who are kind of one foot in, one foot out. And I think that's good, because sometimes we think that, like, our church is the only one that has people that are like, I don't know, and it's like this big problem that has to do with your personal righteousness, whether or not you believe or not is your own personal problem, I guess. And I think that if we can change that language, like, this is a valid place to be, and we're happy to have you there, just even one foot in, that's great. Let's kind of minister to you in that space. I think the church is making progress in their dialogue around doubt, and then a different talk comes out, and I'm like, eh, that wasn't so great. So I can't really say, but at least there's some acknowledgement of that space. So when volunteers are asked how they happen to get involved in an activity, the most common answer is, someone asked me. And I think if you've ever participated in a Mormon congregation, you can say that you've certainly participated in volunteerism beyond what you would have volunteered yourself, because somebody asked you to do something, right? That's what callings are for. That's what the sign-up sheets are for, all of that. But we participate because people ask us. And people who have received help are more likely to help others. And so while I definitely think it's healthy and appropriate to in certain times say, please stop asking me to do stuff. I don't want to engage. Sometimes we stop asking. Sometimes church leaders stop asking people who are not fitting in the box to participate anymore. And they stop being helped. And this is a problem, I think. So the more able the church is able to continue to engage with people that are less orthodox, I think the more they can benefit from those social ties, which are so important, as we've discussed. So this one, I think, is super interesting. People with inconsistent political and religious views, like people who are liberal but religious, or conservative but not religious, are more likely to resolve that discrepancy by changing your religion than by changing your politics. Because if you feel like your church is hostile towards your political views, you're going to leave. So I think that's so interesting, though. Like, we hold on more tightly to our politics and to our church. And to me, this really shows that it's not so much about the doctrine. It's about, do you feel accepted in your church community? And if you don't feel accepted for your political views, you're going to leave. Who cares what the doctrine is? You're going to go find someone else that might not think the same way as you, but will respect you and your views. So the obvious answer is to make a little more room for diverse political views beyond that letter they read over the pulpit like once every 4 years, saying that in theory we support your political views no matter what they are. And I don't know exactly how that works in reality. I think that's probably going to have to be more of a grassroots thing on the ward level, where people feel safe to say things that are less Republican. But I just think that's an interesting point. So how does a faith transition cause you to lose social capital? This slide's a little bit wordy, but so as you're leaving and your doubts increase, your view of the church's trustworthiness goes down. Remember how we talked about trustworthiness being important to social capital? So maybe you're learning about weird things that Joseph Smith did, and you're just like, I don't know if I trust this institution as much. Or maybe you have an experience like, you or your family member is LGBT, and you're like, people are definitely acting in a way that is not wanting me to trust them anymore. Or the church starts trusting you less, right? So as your doubts and orthodoxy or lack thereof becomes more apparent, your trustworthiness kind of goes down, right? Maybe you start making sort of challenging comments in Sunday school, or you have a temple work and an interview and you feel like you can't or won't answer the questions the way you're supposed to. And then you become like a project in ward council. Oh, yeah, we're not going to give them callings anymore, but we need to help them. So does that make sense? So it's all about trustworthiness. Do you feel like the institution is trustworthy? And do they feel like you're trustworthy? And most of the time when your orthodoxy wanes, it's the answer is no. And then as you have less trustworthiness, you miss out on some of that bonding social capital that is so important to your kind of mental health. Here's just a little information about social capital in mixed faith marriages. So in general, interreligious relationships are so common that it's like hardly remarkable. He compares it to like Northern Ireland, where like it's a huge deal to be like a Catholic or Protestant. It's like, hey, like I have a Catholic friend, kind of like it's like, hey, I have a Black friend. You know, it's like, oh, we got to talk about it because it's so unusual. Whereas for most people, it's like not even a big deal. Like, yeah, I have a friend who's Presbyterian. Like, you don't talk about that. Like, it's not a big deal. In America, a third of all marriages are mixed faith marriages, and half of all couples belong that way. So that means that 20% have converted at one point. But why is it a big deal in our faith? Because Mormons are the most opposed to interfaith marriage of all religious groups. And we're also the most religious group in America. And we know that intermarriage correlates to lower religious observance. So in our culture, all those things, that's a problem for us, right? We don't like that idea that if you have a mixed faith marriage, that you might be less active and you might be less religious and my social capital might go down. So what can people do who have left? So about 25% of people who leave the church leave for social issues. And evangelical and Mormon congregations, like I mentioned, emphasize that personal piety and individual beliefs, like, you know, what you do, your choices predict your blessings in life, sort of like that prosperity gospel a little bit. And if you have that belief system, it's really hard to perceive systemic problems like systemic racism and are less likely to endorse systemic efforts towards change, which I think is why sometimes our church is less likely to contribute or participate in like some of those broader philanthropic kind of outreaches. We do some, like, you know, you watch your little thing in between conference and there's like, oh, we delivered wheelchairs to Africa or we built a well, but not quite to the extent of some other religions. Like, we don't have a soup kitchen in our chapel, right? So if that's important to you, the good news is there are other Protestant homes and secular homes that really speak to those social justice issues and systemic change issues that we kind of lack. And so if you feel like the Mormon church is not a safe place for you anymore, there are lots of organizations that can help you feel those Christian values of serving others in a different context. And the other good news is that post-Mormons still have all the skills they learned, the civic engagement skills that they learned, and they're still really great at creating bonding social capital in other ways, like Sunstone or internet groups. You still have all those skills of being able to give talks and organize meetings that you learned growing up as a Mormon, and you can use those skills to create your own little group, to find a new echo chamber. And I think sometimes when we talk about an echo chamber, we use it like in a pejorative sense, like, oh, you're only listening to people like you, so that's not good, because we're all like above that. But in reality, you need a space like that where you feel like you're not alone, like you feel like other people are reflecting back what you're saying. And so there are a lot of spaces out there if you look for them to find that. So how can you engage in the institutional church in a healthy way if you're inclined to do so? I thought this statistic was really interesting. Of all Americans who attend church about once a month, nearly 1 in 20 or 5% is not even sure that she believes in God. So 5% of people who go to any church don't necessarily believe in God. And I think we have this binary thinking dialogue in the LDS church, like, well, of course you have to know if the church is true or not, and it is, so kind of get with the program and believe that, and you'll be happier if you believe that and once you figure that out. But the reality is that you don't necessarily need to know that the church is true to enjoy some of the benefits of attendance, right? And so if you can create a space for you to be a little more flexible and not know, you can still enjoy some of the great things that the church has to offer, like, if it's your thing, ministering, or, you know, some of the service projects, or whatever. And what we find is that religious belonging matters more for, like, being a good neighborly person than religious believing. So it doesn't really matter what you believe or think in terms of doctrine, but it's that you feel like you belong. So if you can be one of those type of people that keeps your thoughts to yourself about certain things, but enjoys the community engagement, that's a valid place to be. And I think sometimes we act like, well, that's not authentic, or that's not legitimate. But for a lot of people, you can kind of have the best of both worlds there, where you have like your side deal, where like intellectually you're engaging on Facebook with like people who know the truth. But you know, but socially you can go to church with your family. You can you know, go to the Christmas party, and you can teach Boy Scouts how to make a Pinewood Derby car or whatever, at least for the next 4 months or something. So Putnam talks about how the highest level of social trust is expressed by people who very often experience God's love but never experience God's judgment, which I think is important. And I think the people who are the happiest in the LDS Church are in that space, right? So if you're feeling a lot of love and not judgment, that's a good place to be. And I think a lot of like truly believing faithful Mormons are in that space, because they're not, they're just buying into the culture, right? Which is great. If you can't buy in anymore, you can still create a space for yourself there, though, using boundary setting skills to engage in a way, or not engage in a way, that helps you feel God's love but not feel his judgment. And so this is kind of like saying, well, I'm not really sure if that generalized reciprocity thing is going to work for me anymore. I'm not sure if I can just give, and just expect something to come back to me that will benefit me. Now I'm not really sure if the benefits are there, but I am willing to engage on a transactional level. So what that can look like is saying yes to things at church only when you believe that the person or the institution that you're engaging with is trustworthy enough to hold up their end of the bargain and provide some sort of benefit to you. Otherwise, just say no. So for example, you may say, well, you know what, I'm going to say no to the temple because I actually don't feel peace there. And if I serve there by doing work for the dead, I leave feeling like more angry than when I came. So I'm actually not going to do that anymore. But I'll say yes to giving a talk because I actually love the idea of being given the opportunity to study a principle of the gospel and then like say whatever I want about it in front of everybody, and nobody can stop me unless I say something really crazy, right? Or saying, you know what, I'm not going to pay my tithing anymore because I don't, you know, I got some issues with the way it's spent, but I'm going to donate my money somewhere else that I think would be used. And I'm going to say yes to that calling for activity days because I think those girls could really use, they need someone who loves them and will spend time with them. Does that make sense? So you can choose how to engage so that you exist in a space where you feel God's love and you don't feel his judgment. And, you know, we sometimes call it cafeteria Mormonism. Everybody's a cafeteria Mormon. You know, you just maybe you're going to be a little more selective than you were before. And that's not a bad thing. Okay. So Brené Brown, this is my last slide. She's great, of course, a prophetess, right? And she talks about this. She says, when we fail to set boundaries and hold people accountable, we feel used and mistreated. And generosity cannot exist without setting boundaries. So many of us have maybe gotten to a place where it's hard to be generous with the church, generous with your time, generous with your money. And you maybe feel like you've been used and mistreated. But if you can learn to set some good boundaries with the church, you can maybe find a place where you can be happy. And for some people, that may be all the way out, way over here. It's just not a place for me anymore. But hopefully, if you're in this presentation, you may be in a spot where you're maybe navigating something. Or maybe if you've got a spouse who's in and you're out, or vice versa, you can find a way to engage in a way that is respectful and useful for everybody. So those are my thoughts. And if anyone has questions, I'm happy to listen. I think they want you to use a microphone to ask questions, which is right there.
Just come up here to the mic.
If a person's ethics that he aspires to want or suggest that he be honest in all things, should a person formally stay in the church who doubts the existence of God or the hereafter?
Well, I think these are all really personal questions to ask. And so, you know, that's a question the temple recommend interview, as we know. Are you honest in your dealings with men? Do you feel like you're an honest person? And I think part of the journey is taking upon yourself the authority to make that decision. I think sometimes we say, like, well, the church gets to decide who's in it. You know, am I the right kind of person to be in the church? Because I don't believe in God, so I probably don't belong. Let me ask them, do you think I belong? You know, but really, that's a personal decision. And in your own ethics and in your own integrity, do you find value in participation? Do you find value in being among people who are trying to be their best version of themselves? Can you find a framing where you're, even though you may not know if God is there, do you have hope that he's there? If you have no hope and no care about it, then maybe that's not the place for you, right? But if you have a desire to engage and, you know, a small seed of hope, there may be, you may find value in being around people that are like you. And I think a lot of this is dependent on your own congregation, right? I've lived in a lot of different places. I'm not super thrilled about the one I'm in now, but I have been in wards that are awesome and super accepting of different positions. And so, I don't know. I think it kind of depends where you are. I don't know if that answered your question or not. But I'm not going to answer it yes or no, so sorry. It's not an answer that would be appropriate for me to give, I think. I'm a therapist, by the way, so I can't tell you what to do about things like that. It's unethical of me to do so.
Explain where the linger longer terminology comes from, and also in your estimation, is the church doing a good job, a mediocre job, or a poor job with their youth activities, their single adults, etc.? And then one other question is, in your statistics using Jana Rees, you had on there, or at least Jana did it, if you fulfill a complete mission, a full 2 years, that only 1 in 10 leave the church. I guess that's on the assumption that number is a little higher than that, but perhaps I'm wrong, so maybe you comment on that too.
Okay, let's see if I can remember all your parts. Let me do the last part first. I agree with you, it sounds low, and I think I would say that I don't know how old the people are who had been surveyed, so it's possible that, like, you know, some of the people are 25 or 30, they are still in the church, but maybe they won't be by the time they're 60, you know, so I don't know the age of the respondents to that question. That would be something you could ask Jana about. For your first question, where did the linger longer come? That was just sort of a play on words. Linger longer is like kind of a thing that some wards I've been in say, like, let's hang out after church and linger longer and have a potluck and hang out together. My father-in-law used to say, linger longer, more like together forever. So, you know, I just use that Mormon phrase, yeah. Linger longer? So the Lutherans started it. Okay. So it's just the idea, hey, let's be together longer because we like each other. Let's hang out. Let's bond. Let's create some bonding social capital. So that's where I got that term from. I just thought I juxtaposed it next to bowling alone. I thought it would be kind of catchy, I guess. I don't know. And then your question was my opinion about how the church is doing with youth programs. I think that's will remain to be seen. I think I'm very curious to see their new direction in 2020. As some of you probably know, it's out with the Boy Scouts. We're done with personal progress. You know, faith in God is going to shift. So I have no idea really what it's going to look like. I have heard from some people say that it's supposed to be sort of equal. I think part of the emphasis was to kind of make the funding and the program equal between boys and girls. This is all like speculation, so don't quote me on this, but I've also heard that it's supposed to be mirrored after like the early life of Jesus, and it's supposed to include like physical and emotional and intellectual and like social like areas, and that there may be some more like individual guidance on creating your own goals and progress, but all of this is hearsay, so I have no idea if that's actually true. But I'm hopeful that the church has like kind of paid attention to what people don't like about the other programs, but I think there is an emphasis on like, let's get rid of, like, skim the fat, get rid of the stuff that we don't need, and really stick to like basic ideas of creating bonding social capital and getting rid of other fluff.
One of the points on one of the slides was that the Mormon church is the most religious. What does that mean?
So that came from, I think, the book American Grace, which there was a big survey done, which I forget what it's called. I think Jana referred to it in her book, The Next Mormons, several times as reference. But I think that probably refers to how religiously observant you are. So not necessarily how spiritual you are, but like how active you are. How many times are you going to church a week? How spiritual do you think you are? How religious do you consider yourself to be? So Mormons consider themselves to be really religious, are very active, attend frequently. You know, we have weekday meetings. And so among all the denominations, we're just very busy in our religion. We participate a lot. We believe a lot. It's like really the center of our lives, a lot more than other traditions. You know, a lot of people can say they're Jewish or Catholic and, like, you know, go to church once or twice a year. But we don't tend to do that as much in the Mormon faith. So that's, I think, what was meant by that.
Kelly, thanks for your presentation. From all what you've been studying with this and focused on, social capital's on the decline. Putnam's research goes back maybe 20 years now or more?
Yeah, his Bowling Alone book came out in 2000.
Yeah, okay. So this is massively on the decline, and people are leaving religion more. So are we just looking at a major shift in social life in the United States, maybe in the Western world? What's going to build more social capital? Is there any chance that something's going to come along that's going to start building more social capital, like in the past, post-World War II and bowling leagues and all that stuff? Or is there a big just fundamental shift happening and we're going to have a different type of society more and more?
Yeah, so obviously I don't really know, but I can give you what I interpret to be Putnam's theory. And I think his theory is that what created all this civic engagement to begin with was the World War II and just this big event that happened, and his theory on why that hadn't happened in subsequent generations is that there wasn't like a big thing that happened, which is on some levels really good, right? It's not like we want to have World War III so that we can come home and I'll be like going to our community activities more. So he did kind of mention, like, I'm not really sure what could shift us all in a different direction. I do think there are some things that have created more activity. You know, his research is kind of older, and I had trouble finding information on has there been a shift back in the other direction in the last 20 years. I do think, at least from my perspective, I think politically maybe it was 9/11, or I think there was a lot of energy in younger voters around like the Obama administration. So I think in some ways younger people have become more engaged in that. Last year when I was here, I talked about the Parkland shooting because I lived in Florida when that happened, right by the school, and young people around gun violence and gun issues, you know, they're having this experience of school shootings that's scary, so they're getting actively involved. So I think as there are experiences that motivate people, they begin to participate. And that's how everything is, right? You don't care about something until you know somebody, you have a reason to care about it, right? So as far as how this relates to the LDS faith, is there going to be something that happens that causes us all to like engage more? I'm not really sure. It's interesting to think about how like the internet has affected it. I think in some ways it pulls us more alone. Like we spend more time, you know, you go to a restaurant and everybody's got their phone out and not talking to each other on one level. But on the other level, you know, like I participate in Facebook groups and stay in touch with people that I never would have. So I think it's not necessarily going to like change directions, or I just think it's, I don't know, it's just a different experience now. I don't really have a great answer for that one either.
And religions don't seem to be pulling together more social capital, at least in the United States.
No, the good news, bad news is that we're not the only ones that are losing lots and lots of members. I think a lot of churches are struggling. The other church denomination that is kind of thriving right now is evangelical Christians. So what the evangelicals are doing that is working is they have these big congregations with like feel-good messages to feel God's love, but not God's judgment, right? Like we talked about. And they're tying that with these small groups. So they have, you know, mega churches with like thousands of members, but then you join a small group that's got like 10 to 20 members and you meet in homes or restaurants and you get to know. So you got kind of the best of both worlds there, where you've got this like non-judgmental, I mean, depending on the congregation, I think there are some that are more conservative and doctrinal. But I think overall, I think a lot of those evangelical Christian churches are trying to be really inclusive and accepting of everybody. And then you've got the small groups where they're nurturing those more personal relationships. So that is kind of a model that is working. And I think the church knows that it's bleeding members, and I think they're trying to be creative in ways to hold on to people. I think the tide of change is painfully slow, so we'll see, but I'm hoping that some ideas will stick. Anybody else? We've got 3 minutes. Any last questions?
So a lot of what you've, at least in the kind of the solution phase, was what can the church do, right? And there's the bottom up, which we're kind of alluding to with Facebook groups and small kind of pockets. And then like the book, it's showing people are leaving and what are they doing and how are they doing it. I think the church is acutely aware of what's happening. But then there's this top down mentality that has been there forever, right? So recently, like with changes in temple and other things, it's clear that they're listening, right? That they've been out gathering information, mm-hmm. finding out what are the problems. The problem, however, of creating this open and more inclusive culture you're talking about, every time we got to a slide, I was like, and how do we do that? How do they do that? So I was just wondering, I don't know if you had just thoughts or things that you've actually seen that institutionally speaking kind of fuel that beyond just generationally we kind of evolve because the kids that had a more liberal view ultimately become the ones that are in charge. And so you end up having to wait basically for somebody else to take the wheel, right? And part of that doesn't feel right. So I'm still searching for ways that we can accelerate how we do that. There's the grassroots, right, which is really all that people have power to do in essence of the way the structure of the church. But have you actually seen programs that have been implemented in places that are helping this, that are kind of church sanctioned, that people have been doing, that have been working? Certainly there's progressive
leaders in stakes and wards where certain programs are there. You always hear about the church, you know, saying we're doing a pilot program, these sorts of things. I'd just like to see if you heard any of that sort of thing that is working on the institutional side to help some of the social change.
Yeah, I think you said a lot of great things. I don't know that I have any new insight, but I definitely think, just like in America, I think generational change is the way it's going to slowly but painfully change. Like I pointed out, the period change, the rapid change, it doesn't happen that often. And the church does have the power to do that. And I think the only way they can know about it and think about it, like I believe that in order to receive revelation, you have to ask the right question. So they have to think about and ask the right question in order to get the right revelation, you know. So as far as like the top level, I don't know. I think continuing the grassroots efforts creates noise, which creates change eventually. I only know of things like you mentioned at like stake and ward levels. I don't know that anybody besides the true higher leaders have the power to make change on a higher level than that. But there are wards and stakes, I think, that are quite progressive. You know, I've heard of Sunday school classes focused on the gospel topic essays, or, you know, support groups in a stake for people that are, you know, less orthodox. So I guess my answer is really no. I don't know or have any specific ideas other than just the general idea that as we talk about a lot with like LGBT issues, you don't care or have empathy until you like have a kid that comes out, and then suddenly you care a lot. And so I think the more the leaders of the church have exposure to people who are in a place of authentic doubt that isn't, like, it's clear it's not sin, it's clear that it's just a transformation, not even a crisis in a bad way, but like just finding a new place, I think that is probably what it will take. And I unfortunately think that will take a lot of time. But I don't really know. So anyway, we're out of time, but I appreciate you coming to the session.